This is an ABC podcast. This is the WA Country Hour with Belinda Varischetti on ABC Radio WA.
Hello, 12:05 here on the Country Hour. Did you hear about that recent research project and the findings of that project showing that there's minimal risk associated with eating a fair bit of red and processed meat? Now, the researchers behind that report have basically ignored the findings of observational studies, saying they're not controlled experiments. So what they've done basically is downgrade the quality of the evidence.
The problem is with taking that approach is that this is the exact same way we figured out that smoking was related to lung cancer. And, like, let's face it, would you volunteer for a study that said, I'm going to put you lot on a high meat diet and I'm going to put you lot on a low meat diet. I'll probably give you all that meat, or I'll give you all the alternatives to the meat, and then I'm going to come back in 20 years and see what you've died from.
You know, I reckon there are a few people that I know who might stick their hand up for that particular study. Now, if you are totally confused about the health risks associated with red and processed meats, then I want you to stick around, because shortly you are going to hear from Professor Claire Collins, and she's a diet and nutritional expert. So hopefully we'll get some clarity around exactly how much processed and red meat you can eat on a weekly sort of basis. That's coming up after 12:30 today. Also, I'm keen to hear what you think about the rebate system, CBH's rebate system, because Pastoralists and Graziers Association thinks it all should be scrapped, and that money that goes into the rebate system should be redirected to just simply reducing the cost of its bulk handling services. What do you think about that? Do you like the rebate system? Do you like that little bonus that you might get partway through the season that you get back in those rebates? Would you rather CBH just keep that and keep on reducing those costs of the operational costs, basically? Let me know. 0448 922 604 is the text. We'll stick with grains for a little bit too, because it sounds like it's currently a very interesting time for Western Australian wheat exports to Indonesia. In the last 3 years, Australia's market share has dropped from 60 to 14%. That's mainly due to factors associated with the eastern states' drought and also that stiff competition from the likes of Argentina and the Black Sea region. But Indonesia's food and feed grain markets are changing, and that could be good news for WA. So last night, John Daly headed along to an event in Perth that was hosted by GIWA, the grains industry of Western Australia. And some of the guest speakers had come over from Indonesia, so he was keen to hear what they had to say.
So I'm here at the Grain Industry Association of WA's ASEAN Food and Feed Grain Opportunities Forum, talking about not just opportunities but also challenges. And with me now I have Richard Simonides, who is the CEO of AGIC, as well as Erwin Sudharma, who is a representative from the Indonesian Flour Millers Association, and Desi Utomo, you're the chairman of the Indonesian Feed Millers Association. And I've also got Bob Nixon, who's the chair of the Grains Industry Association of WA. Welcome, gentlemen. How are you?
Very well.
That's good. Now, just to start off with, I wanted to start off with you, Erwin. A large proportion of wheat being imported into Indonesia is now coming from the Black Sea and Argentina. Some pretty stiff international competition. Australia's market share slipped down, expected to slip to 14%. What can we do to get back in the game when it comes to the Indonesian flour market?
Yeah. First, I believe we need to have the availability of the wheat supply or seaweed supply in the market. If it's available, means the price also will be compared enough to the US or Canadian. It's not fair to compare the price of seaweed with the Black Sea, because it's really different quality. But we need to consider the same price level with US and Canada.
Now, Richard, I mean, that touches on an interesting point in terms of cost competitiveness. The drought has obviously had some effects on Australia's wheat supply. How are we going to overcome that cost side of things going forward?
I mean, the obvious answer is rain. We, yeah. You know, we've had the most expensive wheat in the world for the last 15 months or so, just driven by the demand pull from the East Coast. And until that corrects and we see an exportable surplus come back on the supply side and the price correction that comes with that, it is going to be tough for Australia to trade into, you know, world parity pricing.
Erwin, one thing that you mentioned, which was quite interesting to hear, was the trend in millennial consumers. Indonesia itself has a huge rise in the middle class. I think it was up on the slide, 140% expected to grow by 2020. Mm-hmm. What the young people are eating and expecting from their food is changing. How do you see that in terms of an opportunity for Australia?
The good things about millennial is they are creating the new markets, new model, new style, which is we need to understand. That's why I believe we as the supplier, whether from the Australian or whether from the flour mill or feed mill, we need to understand this new customer, how they react, how they thinking, how their way of life. And once we understand, then we can follow what they need. Is quite significant difference compared to the previous generation, this millennial generations, how they spend the money. They want to buy the experience. That's why we need to create more value compared to the price only.
It sounds like the way the market's heading is potentially moving away from being so sensitive to cost, which could be an opportunity
yes,
for us.
Yes, that's true. Yes.
Do you see that as an opportunity, Richard?
Definitely there. As people get richer and the population demographics change, there will be a change in consumption patterns. So, you know, what we see, and it's well documented, is that as people get richer, historically they've been eating rice, they'll move to a noodle product, then to a bakery product, then to a pastry or a confectionery product, and then more animal protein. With the millennials, there's another step beyond that, which is this experience consumption or very conscientious decision-making about how can I get a unique experience from food. And, you know, Erwin in his presentation spoke about image and, you know, how can they present their own personality through the experiences that they populate onto social media and those sorts of things. So it will definitely become a new class of consumer. And over time, we'll start to understand how to engage with it.
Aside from the flour miller side of things, there's also potential opportunity in the feed market in Indonesia. I mean, just recently in March, Indonesia and Australia penned the Comprehensive Economic Partnership Agreement, and that's going to pave the way to 500,000 tonnes of feed grain potentially coming into Indonesia free of tariffs. Where are we at with that in Desi from the Feed Millers Association? Do you see Australia having an opportunity in the feed space in Indonesia going forward?
There's a big opportunity for Australian wheat to be exported, feed wheat to be exported to Indonesian as the feed raw materials, because in the same time we are still having problem with the supply of the corn. So the issue having special treatment for the ICP without any additional duty, it means that more competitive price.
You've changed. So, Desi, a huge part of the feed market in Indonesia is, of course, chicken feed.
Yeah.
That's mainly been based around corn, but yeah. You're starting to change the mix yeah. into wheat, which is, I guess, good for Australian wheat producers.
Yeah, actually, we are not aiming deliberately to change from corn move shifting to the wheat, but because of the price of the corn locally is not rational, prices keep increasing, so the existing wheat substitution is more giving more space for the nutritionist to adopt the source, alternative source of energy besides corn.
In regards to chicken feed, Richard, the chicken feed market in Indonesia, feed grain in general, is there an opportunity there where we can't compete necessarily with the people selling to flour millers?
We will struggle to compete in a feed market with low-cost producers like Black Sea, Russia, Argentina. But there will always be, in most years in Australia, there'll be some low-quality wheat which can be sold into that market. Maybe it's been weather damaged or something like that. There's a bigger decision into the future about whether we want to start to grow custom-bred feed wheats to service this market, because the growth potential is much bigger than the food market.
I mean, some of the figures coming from the feed market, it's currently got a 25 million tonne capacity. You mentioned in your talk, Desi, that that could grow to 40 million tonnes in the next 10 years. Yeah. Considering that you're starting to use a little bit more wheat in the chicken feed mix, is there potentially a, you know, a long-term opportunity there, Richard?
There's a theoretical limit to domestic corn production, and right now there's price pressure on that because the government support programs, you know, are encouraging the use of domestic corn and the lack of supply of imported corn. So domestic corn in Indonesia will not be able to supply all of the energy needs for chicken into the future. So where the balance comes from, whether it's imported corn, whether it's imported wheat, you know, that'll play out and it'll be closely linked to government policy, I suspect. Yeah. But, you know, the one thing that's true is that across all of the ASEAN nations, the feed markets are growing massively, and, you know, that demand will be there as people get richer, they're eating more meat.
And as an industry, is it an either-or proposition? Do we say, let's go for the flour millers, the high end of the market, or let's focus where the growth potential is?
Oh, look, I think for Australia, it would be crazy for us to try and make this an either-or situation. Mm. We've got a traditional strength in noodle. Most of the wheat, milling wheat coming out of Australia is going into noodle production. And from a functionality point of view, we've got the best wheat in the world for doing that. So why would we give up on that? So that's a strength, but then there's also opportunity in feed. Equally, there's opportunities in the baking sector and, you know, the biscuit and cake and cookie sectors. So as an industry, we have to work together and understand what's the smart way to engage with those opportunities without destroying what we're already good at.
As the CEO of AGIC, what is your organisation doing to achieve that, to get that understanding?
Yes, so the main change agency that we work through is Wheat Quality Australia. So exactly these sort of market signals that we've been discussing will get fed back through the Wheat Classification Council of Australia, which helps us make decisions about how do we set our controls and how do we bring new varieties through the breeding programs to engage with these market opportunities. Really important to make sure that we have a market-driven classification system that's responding to market signals.
Now, Bob Nixon, you're a farmer at Killarney. You're also the chairman of GIWA. When you hear these market signals, what do you think of, when you think of the crops you're growing back at your place?
I think, firstly, today, when Irwin spoke, it was actually nice to hear that they do still prefer our West Australian, Australian grain, and once seasonal conditions dictate that we do have another big crop, a 30 million ton crop or whatever it is, then we will hopefully be able to compete back into Indonesia. And the other exciting thing was listening to Desi, that growth in feed demand in Indonesia. You know, in the last 10 years they've grown from 10 to or 11 to 20 million ton of grain used in mainly the chicken industry, and that's projected to grow to as much as 40 million tonnes. So yeah, looking forward, it's exciting, there's huge opportunity.
And in regards to your particular things that you plant and what you do on the farm, does this make you think, oh, well, maybe I should start growing some of those lower protein wheats until the flour millers come back on board? Or
I think in a perfect world, we will still chase the premium markets, but it is nice to know that with that feed market growing quicker than the milling market, that, you know, for whatever reason, whether it's a lack of break crops or, you know, really good seasonal conditions, for the years where we don't grow protein when it's diluted by production, that we do have really good opportunities and markets for that lower protein grain when we do produce it.
Bob, Desi, Irwin, Richard, thank you, gentlemen, for joining me, and enjoy the rest of your night.
Thanks.
Thank you.
John Daly at last night's GIWA event in Perth. It was called ASEAN Food and Feed Grain Opportunities Forum. And he was talking to Richard Simonitis, who is the CEO of AGIC, that's the Australian Export Grains Innovation Centre, Kalani farmer Bob Nixon, who's also the chair of GIWA, Erwin Schudemar from the Association of Flour Millers in Indonesia, and also Desian Dubudodemu, who is the chairman of the Indonesian Feed Millers Association. This is the Country Hour, and it's 20 past 12. Farm lobby group, the Pastoralists and Graziers Association, wants CBH's grower rebate system scrapped and all the money and effort directed to reducing the cost of its bulk handling services. Last month, the state's main grain handler announced WA grain growers would receive only $1 per tonne rebate from the 2018-2019 season, the total rebate of $16 million to be delivered from CBH operations, and not a cent from the marketing and trading division or investments. Gary McGill is the Grains Committee Chairman with the PGA. Gary, why is the PGA so opposed to the rebates?
Belinda, PGA's always been somewhat opposed to the concept of rebates on offer to their shareholders in those three areas that they have an interest in. We consider them to be gimmicky. The main one, of course, that in marketing and trading, we've made the point before, we make it again, that CBH grain should be just competing on an even playing field as everybody else is, so that the grower can make a decision based on what's on offer on the day and not have to worry about whether there's some sort of gimmicky rebate on offer. In terms of the bulk handling component of the rebates, we say this and have always said it: if CBH has the capacity to engage in some such return or rebate like this, it must have the capacity to look at straightforward, plain reduction in bulk handling charges. We think that the grower of WA would be much more interested in seeing that upfront outcome than having to be worried about whether there's some sort of gimmicky rebate on offer. CBH have been saying to us now for a few years that it's vitally important that we get ourselves into a competitive environment or competitive place with the market, the Black Seas and the Argentinas. And one of the ways it can be done is getting some reductions in that bulk handling sector between the farm gate and the blue water. And we don't believe rebates are the way to do that.
CBH always argues, though, that it does offer growers here in Western Australia the cheapest handling fees in the country.
Makes no impression on us, Belinda. They've been saying that for decades. The facts are that the West Australian growers' competitor is the international marketplace, not the eastern states. So cost comparisons with bulk handling authorities and other areas in the east mean nothing. What we have to look at is compare ourselves with the international market. And we now know that places such as the Black Sea and Argentina, massive infrastructure being developed and investment in those areas, making those places in the world highly competitive. That's where we look to. That's where we've got to compare ourselves, not the eastern states. Makes no impression on us.
Don't some growers in certain years, and this one might be one of those, really appreciate that rebate coming back to the farm gate to sort of get them through some challenging times?
If you had a cheaper bulk handling price, for example, then that's back to the farm gate. If you had a higher price being posted by CBH, maybe a little bit more competitive than somebody else, that comes back to the farm gate. They are the mechanisms, rather than picking and choosing gimmicky rebate systems.
Do you think some growers actually make up their mind about who they're going to sell their grain to based on the possibility of that rebate coming back into the system for them?
I don't know, Belinda. I mean, I don't. And I know a lot of my colleagues don't. The folly of that in the decision-making, you can see for yourself. I don't know. Maybe some people do. How they know, I don't know, because you don't know to the end of the program about what your rebates are. I would have thought that most people would be saying, well, today I wish to sell a parcel of grain, and you look at the prices available on the day, and that's it. That's what you make your judgments on.
And is the PGA, are you opposed to any of the rebates? Because it does sort of come from those three different areas. There is operations, the marketing and trading side, and the third area being the investments. And obviously this year, due to difficult circumstances, nothing coming from marketing and trading and nothing coming from the investments in the flour mills or the oat facility.
Yeah, well, there you go. There's the point that we make. It's all over the place. You don't know what's going to be happening. If anybody thinks that it's worthwhile having rebates from overseas investments, and we've seen this year where there's probably going to be some trouble in relation to that, we make the point that a cooperative, if you believe in the cooperative, and most apparently in WA do, if you believe in the cooperative, there are benefits accruing to people. Costs and benefits should be equally distributed. That's what the cooperative principle is about. And we don't think that the rebate system, we don't believe the rebate system is the appropriate mechanism for that. Just go straight out and say, we are going to be doing some things here that are going to reduce your bulk handling costs, for example. And that's then going to sheet home to the farm gate. That's what the company should be all about.
Do you think there's more transparency in the rebate system, though? Because when there is a profit, say in the marketing, trading, in the investments, for example, then you actually see that physically coming back as a rebate rather than the other way, or we're just reducing costs as much as we can.
Well, in marketing and trading, that's only going to happen if you happen to have sold to CBH. I mean, people sell to a whole lot of other people too. So that's the only place where that's going to happen. If this was a private, publicly listed entity, a corporate entity or something, they can do as they please and they'll be judged on their merits. If we had a competitive environment in bulk handling, that would be a different circumstance. We don't have that. We have CBH offering up a monopoly service in bulk handling. Fortunately, not in marketing and trading. Farmers do have some options available to them. But in the big ticket item of bulk handling, it's a service, a monopoly service provider. There's almost no competition. So we would prefer CBH to be much more energetically and aggressively reducing the big ticket cost component between the farm gate and the blue water, which is bulk handling. The rail freight is another big ticket item. So in areas like that, wherever possible, the cost to be reduced to allow the West Australian export grain grower to be competitive in the international marketplace. Don't compare us to the eastern states or any, but it's irrelevant. It is the international marketplace, and that's where we believe if we have to have a monopoly service provider in these areas, that monopoly service provider has a duty to get those costs down, and I think there's capacity to do it even more than what they are doing, and the rebate system is not the mechanism.
Gary, good to talk to you. Thank you so much for being on the Country Hour today.
Okay, thank you.
Gary McGill from the Grains Committee with the Pastoralists and Graziers Association. So what do you think of that? I mean, PGA has long held that opinion on the rebate system and would rather it scrapped and all that money going into pulling down that cost of the bulk handling services just as much as possible. Let me know what you think. 0448 922 604. Do you agree with that, or do you quite like getting that rebate towards, well, just before the harvest is about to start, getting the announcement anyway of what that's going to be this year? 0448 922 604 is the text. Rob on the text says the rebate system is just money shuffling for the purpose of propaganda. Totally unnecessary given CBH's monopoly position in storage and handling. Rebates, given they are an unknown amount, distort the market, according to Rob. 0448 922 604. On CBH and what's going to happen this season, because for the first time this harvest, the CBH group is going to provide Wi-Fi access to growers and transporters. This is at the key receival sites. This is part of improvements made to the CDF app, which is all about making deliveries quicker and easier. And the app was introduced across the network last season, and it replaces the traditional paper form, the Carter's delivery form, and it's basically required for each load that's delivered to a CBH receival site. The Wi-Fi networks have been installed at 70 receival sites and remote sample huts, 38 of which have been identified as having poor or no mobile phone reception. So how it works is the CDF app will automatically detect that Wi-Fi network that's been set up. So when the truck arrives at the site, you'll be prompted to connect, and then it's up to you whether you're going to accept that or not. And just before we check in with the news headlines today. It looks as though Kalium Lakes might have won the race to become Australia's first sulphate of potash producer. Kalium Lakes Board has just approved the full development of its sulphate of potash project, which is located 160 kilometres southeast of Newman in WA's Pilbara region. Now, sulphate of potash is rich in potassium, so it's a really good fertiliser component, and that's why it's so valuable. Kalium Lakes hopes to start production late next year. There are a few other companies trying to get projects off the ground in WA, but there aren't that many in the world, so it will be interesting to see how Kalium Lakes goes and if the other projects get into production as well. 12:30 on the Country Hour. Sandra Shimane-Burke is in the studio. What's making the headline, Sandra?
Hello, Belle. A Senate inquiry has heard there's been a spike in complaints about the so-called robo-debt scheme as money is collected out of people's tax returns. The Commonwealth Ombudsman says his office usually receives about 100 complaints a month about the program, which matches tax office income data with that reported by welfare recipients. The WA Police Commissioner says body-worn cameras for officers will be rolled out in Geraldton within the next 2 weeks. It follows the fatal police shooting of a 29-year-old mother, Joyce Clark, last month, who had a history of mental health issues. A 35-year-old man has been charged with leaving his three-month-old baby in a parked car while he went shopping. It's alleged he parked in an undercover car park at Armidale Shopping Centre yesterday afternoon and was gone for about half an hour. And anti-domestic violence charity White Ribbon says it's profoundly sad that it has to shut down. The organisation has gone into liquidation, saying it became necessary after an analysis of its future sustainability. Belle, I'll be back at 1 o'clock with a full bulletin.
Thank you, Sandra. 28-1.
The WA Country Hour with Belinda Varaschetti on ABC Radio WA.
Good to have you along this afternoon. Just following along from the conversation with Gary McGill from the PGA, just saying he's not a supporter of the rebate system that the state's main grain handler, the CBH Group, provides each year. I think it's since 2009 that system's been in place. And your thoughts most welcome this afternoon. This from the average farmer on the text. Hi, Belinda. Why do we have to listen to the PGA's view on our CBH? They have shown they are anti-cooperative. Most would sell their mother for a profit. 0448 922 604 if you want to pick up on that conversation. Also, between now and the news at 1, the results of the Mount Barker cattle market for you. Also, you're going to meet the new chair of Animal Health Australia, which will be interesting in light of the conversations we've been having over the last couple of days, focusing on African swine fever. It spreads from China through other parts of Asia, and the efforts that Australia is making now to try and keep it out of this country. And also, how much processed and red meat you should be eating. That's to come on the Country Hour between now and the news at 1. Off to the Weather Bureau, and Robbie Rivette has the details today. Robbie, how's it looking in northern and eastern parts?
Well, it's almost sky clear up there at the moment. There's a bit of queue forming over the interior, but yeah, not expecting any significant weather through most parts today, apart from some, we've got a fire weather warning in the northern interior and Kimberley today with severe to extreme fire dangers through that area.
And beyond.
We are seeing, I suppose, a slight chance of a thunderstorm in the far north Kimberley over the weekend and early next week. But apart from that, it could get a bit windy in the southern parts due to a deep low we've got forming sort of just southwest, well, just west of the southwest corner of the state. And we're also looking at a fire weather warning through the north and south interior and far northeast sort of gold fields for tomorrow.
All right. And is that as far as we can see for northern and eastern parts at this stage, or you want to take us into the weekend and
Yeah, generally sunny for next week, and that slight chance of a thunderstorm, so the far northern Kimberley. All the weather action is still mostly happening in southern parts.
All right, well, let's move there and talk us through this afternoon and the rest of the week into the weekend.
Yep, so we've got a cut-off low forming sort of, I suppose, west of Perth at the moment, and that will deepen tonight and cross the coast sometime during Friday, probably in the afternoon, and along the coast somewhere between sort of Perth and Busselton. Exactly where that low crosses the coast is, I suppose, will affect the weather. But near and to the north of that low, we're looking at gale force winds, the potential for gusts to 100 kilometres per hour over land, and some sort of, I suppose, frequent showers as that low crosses the coast. Adding in that, potential damaging surf on the coast and tides that are a bit higher than high tide. So we'll be issuing a severe weather warning sometime soon. And, yeah, it'll be worth looking at that and considering that tomorrow will be wet and windy through much of the southwest corner.
Great. Warnings this afternoon?
We've got a strong wind warning. Strong wind warning, Cape Naturalist to Albany, with gales developing offshore from Cape Leeuwin this evening. And then tomorrow, we've got gales forecast in the coastal waters from Geraldton to offshore from Albany. And strong winds extending from near Shark Bay all the way around to almost Eucla, and also in the waters near Exmouth. We've got the fire weather warning for sort of inland northeastern parts of the state. And we're potentially having the severe weather warning for Lower West, far northwestern Great Southern, western central Wheat Belt, and southern central coast. And that includes the potential for dangerous surf, tides higher than normal. But the main one there is the damaging gusts, with gusts about 100 kilometres per hour possible. And then I suppose I should add, on Saturday and Sunday, that with that low pressure moving east and south, we'll see the weather sort of contracting to the south coast during Saturday, and then, just some showers on the south coast and more normal conditions on Sunday.
Thanks, Robbie. 24 to 1. Just checking the rainfall figures for you now, and no rainfall in northern and eastern districts of the state in the last 24 hours to 9 o'clock this morning. So straight to the southwest land division, and in the southwest of the state, Busselton, Aero and Cape Naturalist had 5, Kawarumup, 4 acres, Jindong, Margaret River, Millionup, and Rosabrook all had 6 mils. Scott River with 9, Warner Glen 6, Willyabrup 5, and Wychcliffe had 9.
The WA Country Hour with Belinda Barischetti on ABC Radio WA.
Western Australia's commercial crayfishers are annoyed they weren't consulted before yesterday's announcement that charter boat operators will soon be allowed to double the size of their cray catch. From November, maximum pot numbers per charter vessel will double. For boats carrying up to 6 passengers, the allowable catch increases from 24 to 40 crays. And larger boats carrying more than 10 passengers will soon be allowed to take up to 80 crays. The announcement was made by State Fisheries Minister Dave Kelly, but the state government and Western Rock Lobster Council still haven't agreed on the amount of crayfish that should be made available to the local market. So today, the Western Rock Lobster Council issued a media release saying its members are disappointed they weren't included in discussions about this new 3-year trial. Justin Piratina is a charter boat operator, but he's also a commercial cray fisherman. He doesn't think these changes will create new jobs in the charter industry, and he's disappointed the commercial fishing industry has been sidelined.
It hasn't gone to any consultation with any of our peak bodies. When I spoke to the Westbrook Lobster Council yesterday, of which I've just been voted back on last week, they didn't know about it at all. Every cray that we catch is logged. They know exactly how many kilos we're catching in the rec sector where these extra crays are coming from. I think that's what's going to be the problem. It'll put a lot of pressure on the recreational sector because these guys are now catching them on a charter boat. We'll be catching them in the shallower waters that are generally the professionals have sort of moved away from since quotas come in. So it'll definitely put pressure on the recreational sector. So I can't believe Recfish West are on board with it, to be honest. I think it's got to come a time soon where we need to know exactly how many crays are coming out of the rec sector. I mean, they're allowed 5% of the TACC, but no one knows if they're close to it, past it, over it. This could take a lot of extra crays out of the water.
Justin, Fisheries Minister Mr Kelly says that the, as you say, the commercial rock lobster industry hadn't been consulted, but also wouldn't be impacted. Do you? What's your response to that?
Well, I think we're all pretty well aware that Minister Kelly has no idea of this portfolio with the debacle of his handling over the last 6 to 8 months. He has got no idea. He doesn't come to any meetings. Even before this happened, he's never been to one of our meetings, even though he's been asked at numerous occasions. I think this is just his way, and there'll be more others of his way of sort of trying to get back at what's the way of losing what he thought he lost last year and earlier this year.
Geraldton fisherman Justin Puritina with Dominique Baines. Western Rock Lobster Council Chairman Terry Listerman says this 3-year trial has no cap and will be administered under the recreation allocation, which he thinks is already exceeded, even before you factor in numbers of lobsters going to the black market. But the government has made these changes so more tourists will get a chance to have a decent feed of crayfish. What do you make of it all? Let me know this afternoon on the text 0448 922 604. On the Country Hour, it's 19 to 1. Heading to the north of the state now, where farmers in the Ord Valley are expecting their biggest maize season yet, with ongoing drought leaving a gap in supply from the major corn-growing regions in the east. For the past 3 years, growers in the area have operated a joint effort with the Ord River District Cooperative to export the product to the South Korean market for corn chips. There's also a growing demand from local pastoralists in the region to use the product for cattle feed. Courtney Fowler headed over to Oasis Farms in Kununurra, where local grower Fritz Bolton has just fired up the harvester.
We only just started the corn in earnest yesterday. This year the crop has taken a lot longer to mature. We've had a really cold dry season and just hasn't had the heat units to like we normally have, so it's been a bit of delayed harvest for us.
So we've just driven past the harvester. You've started getting some of the corn off. Are you happy with the corn that you're seeing come out of the bins this year?
We've certainly put a lot more management and a lot more know-how into this year's crop. We've set some fairly high benchmarks and I think it's too early to say whether we've achieved what we aim for, but the crops look good. The cobs and the kernel size is exceptional. So I'm hoping that these extremely cold nights that we've had won't affect the crop.
You've had 3 years where you yourself and a couple of the other farmers around the valley have been involved in this joint effort to export Ord corn over to South Korea. How much corn are you expecting to go over there in this fourth year?
So we'll have more corn than ever going over there, and that's due to the drought conditions over east, and it's because we're always looking for long-term relationships, and we're looking for customers that we can plan out into the future with, and the team at Ordco have done a really good job at helping us to fine-tune that. And I think this year we've just hit a new high. It's been really exciting to watch, and I think it's something that's really important, especially when there's drought. And I think we're going to see more and more of it. This climate variability that we're seeing, these extreme weather events that we're seeing it on the East Coast where there hasn't been rain. We have just seen it here in this dry season. We've had probably our coldest dry season on record. And I would think that these extreme weather conditions are going to continue, and it's going to become harder and harder to shore up product that's grown on farm all over Australia and the world.
And then I suppose more important than ever that you have these sort of relationships established with customers like you have over in South Korea to fill these gaps in the market as well.
Yeah, and it's not only in South Korea. We've also got substantial local customers that we're also really excited about working with. We're hoping that the cattle producers that are feeding grain are getting a good bang for their buck. And so I would have thought that that the more grain we can securely produce, that the more the customers will jump on board and reap the benefits of that too. The key is that if we need to produce extra, we need a year's notice. It takes a year to plan a crop cycle and to plan the marketing, and that's really a key to what we've been trying to achieve up here.
Where do you see the future of this crop going in the valley?
We see our future as cotton growers, and to be a successful cotton grower you need good rotations, and I think that corn will continue to be a very important part of that rotation, and I think the cotton seed will supplement that, notwithstanding the relationships that we've built these last few years with our corn customers. So I think it will end up being a good base crop for the valley. And we've been here nearly 40 years and have basically, that's what we've been looking for. It's very easy to grow crops when prices are high, like at the moment, but you need to be able to do it when prices are a bit more challenging. And that's what we're always aiming at, so that we can survive the tough times.
Kununurra farmer Fritz Bolton with Courtney Fowler. And some of that Kununurra corn is set to leave Wyndham Port next week, with another two shipments expected to head to Korea in the coming months. And this export deal builds on the growers' success in the 2018 season, which saw 20,000 tonnes delivered out of the port, and that figure is expected to rise significantly this year. 14 to 1, just picking up on the conversation about rebates and whether you're a supporter or not of the rebates coming from CBH, if you're a grain grower. This just through, I'm against the rebate. As an Esperance grain grower, consistently our grain is $10 to $15 less than Kwinana, even though the shipping freight is only $3. This is the profit that is then sent back as a rebate to everyone. Just offer it as a comparative price. Stop ripping off the Esperance growers.
On ABC Radio WA, you're with Belinda Barischetti for the WA Country Hour.
And good to have you along. We'll get to the market shortly, off to Mount Barker for the results of the cattle market just before the news at 1 o'clock. First, though, a nutrition expert has labelled the findings of a controversial new study that's reignited debate over whether red and processed meat causes cancer as confusing and misleading. A team of international researchers led by Dalhousie University and McMaster University in Canada ultimately recommended people keep eating the same amount of red and processed meat. The findings have infuriated health professionals around the world, but as you'd imagine, they've been welcomed by the livestock industry. Professor Claire Collins is Director of Research at the School of Health Sciences at the University of Newcastle. She says these latest recommendations go against the advice of health organisations around the world, including the World Health Organisation.
It's really confusing, because when you look at the data that's in these papers, each of the four reviews show that the people who eat the most processed meat and red meat have higher risk for dying from anything, and then heart disease, type 2 diabetes, and some specific cancers. And then they make recommendations that we shouldn't change the amount of meat we eat. So everybody must be feeling totally confused, like, what's going on?
What are your concerns with how the researchers involved in this project have actually reached their conclusions? And that is that main conclusion that the risks of eating red meat are minimal and that the evidence is too weak to prove that those risks are even real.
Well, what they're hinging their recommendations on is the fact that the bulk of the evidence does come from what are called observational studies. Now, an observational study is where you take a huge population of people, and across all the studies included in these reviews, that's around 6 million people, you look at how much meat people eat, and we know that people basically rarely change their eating patterns a great deal. It follows them up, and depending on the study, you know, 5 years, 10 years, 20 years, and it looks at what they've died from. And when you have huge, huge numbers of people, you can add these studies together and pretend it's one giant world study. And what that evidence tells us is that people on the higher meat, higher amounts of processed meat are more likely to die from these conditions. And they've gone, well, they're observational studies, they're not experiments, so we're going to downgrade the quality of the evidence and say they weren't randomised controlled trials. The problem is, with taking that approach, is that this is the exact same way we figured out that smoking was related to lung cancer. And that is really what got us on the path to saying, you know what, I think everybody shouldn't be smoking, and then to eventually banning it.
So is everyone just confused now? You see these stories all the time. One day red wine is good for you, one day it's bad. One day chocolate's good for you, one day it's bad. Now the same with red meat. What does it mean for consumers sitting there scratching their heads going, well, now I don't know what to eat?
Well, I think consumers should not feel confused. All the major organisations around the world, the heart foundations, the cancer councils, have basically said these people are being mischievous and trying to deliberately confuse people. Their own results show that there's a higher risk of dying and getting those major diseases, but we acknowledge that they are observational studies. And, like, let's face it, would you volunteer for a study that said, I'm going to put you lot on a high meat diet and I'm going to put you lot on a low meat diet, and I'll probably give you all that meat, or I'll give you all the alternatives to the meat, and then I'm going to come back in 20 years and see what you've died from. You cannot do that kind of study, so it's absolute nonsense to say that the observational studies mean something.
Well, nonetheless, the Red Meat Advisory Council has welcomed the report. Here's what RMAC's Don Mackay had to say about it.
Well, I think any supporting scientific evidence that outlines why the consumption of red meat, which has been a staple protein supply for humans for thousands of years, that it is in fact good for you. There's little doubt that there are plenty of people or individuals and organisations who, for whatever reasons, would seek to have red meat consumption reduced. So this sort of reports really does support our industry, and appropriately.
Professor Claire Collins, what do you make of that?
I mean, that's not surprising. But let's come back to the Australian guidelines. The Australian guidelines fit with the evidence about higher risk at higher consumptions of red meat say that don't go over around half a kilo of the leanest meat you can afford every week. Basically, we know that in Australia, if we ate like the guidelines, which, by the way, includes eating 5 servings of veggies a day, that our burden and the amount of money we pay for poor health in Australia, it had dropped by 62% for heart disease and 40% for type 2 diabetes, 33% for stroke, and over 20% for bowel cancer. So the bottom line is, avoid processed meat, keep your leanest red meat you can afford intake to less than half a kilo a week, eat more fish, eat more whole grains, eat more fruit, eat more veggies, and that's the key to feeling better and getting better if you're already unwell.
The scientific community has been up in arms over this, with many criticising the report's authors, saying it's even unethical. Is that really fair? Is there not meant to be room in the scientific community for such type of research and debate, and for the other sides, I suppose, of the story or the coin to be discussed?
Yeah, there's definitely room for debate, but I think you have to question when the data they've presented showed that there was higher risk for these health conditions, but they've concluded, therefore, do not change anything because the risk is small and because the evidence comes from observational studies. That's the part that doesn't really make sense. And some of the authors, interestingly, are the same group who conducted reviews some years back that said there's no evidence to reduce our intake of sugar. So, you know, I think we've got to drill a little bit more into what the motivations are and why so blatant attempt to confuse the public.
There's been concern that this report could be used in the development or updating of dietary guidelines. For example, Australia's nutritional guidelines suggest eating 455 grams of red meat per week. Do you think this study could have an impact on future guidelines?
No, it won't, because while there are additional studies to when we developed the guidelines, which were released in 2013, the bottom line is that there is still increased risk.
Professor Claire Collins from the University of Newcastle with Marty McCarthy. And this just threw on the text from Matty. I'm volunteering for the study. My specialty is eating bacon. I knew there'd be one there. 6 minutes to 1. Kids running around this year's Royal Show are getting involved in some hands-on activities that teach them all about agriculture and food production here in WA, and it's fun. The Department of Primary Industries and Regional Development has set up the Deeper Discoverers exhibit in the Farm to Food Pavilion for the first time this year, and it's a big hit. This was right up John Daly's alley. So with a little help of DPIRD's Karen Carrero, he became a DPIRD discoverer.
So first what you're going to do is you're going to pick up your activity sheet.
Yep.
And we've got a number of activities for you to complete today. And when you've completed your activities, you will be presented with a certificate. First off, we're going to ask you, though, to look at managing pests and diseases. We're going to ask you to firstly know what a European wasp looks like, and then we're going to ask you to see how many you can actually count in this lovely, colourful mural wall that we've got in front of you right now.
So this seems to be a very popular display
this
over here.
This one is popular, so you might have to wait for your fishing pole because we're going to ask you to go fishing, catch your fish, and measure your fish. We want to make sure that you've got the right size fish, and there's a ruler on the side of the fish tank for you. When you've made sure it's the correct size, we're going to ask you then to release that fish as well. And it's really about educating our children and their parents in responsible fishing, and also remembering that we've got a wonderful sea life and ecology that we have to protect in Western Australia.
Great. All right. And then moving on from that, step number 3, global competitiveness.
Yes. Now,
what's all about?
We have found that the children love this exercise. We ask them to go to a box, pick out their wooden cube, see what picture they have. They might have a picture of a strawberry, or they might have a picture of a piece of steak or a prawn. And we ask them then to follow the pathway in terms of a maze and find out which country is really a predominant trade partner for Western Australia.
Why did DPIRD decide to take a bit more of a hands-on, child-focused approach this year to the Royal Show?
We know that in the main, the Perth Royal Show attracts a lot of families and a lot of children. Future generations of people that will actually help with our food chain production, people that might become scientists, work in agriculture. And it's not just a case of bringing it out of your supermarket trolley, and that's where it magically appears from. There are a lot of farmers that put a lot of time and effort and love into producing our food for us. And so it's a very important engagement opportunity.
Hello, what's your name?
Audrey.
Audrey, you've just become a DPIRD discoverer. What did you learn?
I learned where food comes from.
Where does it come from?
Fish come from the water and then they go into a boat, and then they go on the truck
And what country did they go to?
They went to Hong Kong.
Hong Kong, wow. Mum, she's learned so much just in a few minutes.
Yeah, definitely.
Audrey, one of the DPIRD discoverers with the department's Karen Carrero and John Daly at the Perth Royal Show. Let's get to the markets, to the cattle sale at Mount Barker today, a little bit smaller than last week's yarding. And David Monk is covering the sale today. David, can you run through the details?
Good afternoon, Belinda. Numbers were backed by 423 yarding of 968 cattle at Mount Barker. It was a good quality yarding with good numbers of ideal feeder cattle, along with a much better selection of cows. There were only a few pens of ground steers and heifers yarded. Not all the regular buyers were present, with the absence of a major export processor. Young feeder steers were up to 14 cents dearer, with the feeder steers selling from 245 to 340, with the medium weight feeder steers averaging 325. The feeder heifers were 13 to 17 cents dearer, selling from 200 to 288, with the lightweights averaging 265 and the medium weights 254 cents. The heavier weight feeder heifers over 400 kilograms averaged 273. Young cattle of the restockers sold at similar rates to the previous sale, with the young steers selling from 240 to 340, while the young restocker heifers sold from 140 to 274. The few ground steers yarded were 8 cents dearer, selling from 220 to 272, while the ground heifers were up to 15 cents dearer, with the better type selling from 214 to 256. With the absence of a major cow buyer, the cow market was 11 to 15 cents cheaper. Two score cows to the processors sold from 130 to 170, while the better three and four scores sold from 140 to 216, with the prime heavyweights averaging 204. Plain conditioned cows to the restockers were also a little cheaper, selling from 80 to 164. Bulls sold at similar rates, with the better types selling from 200 to 220, while the young bulls to the restockers sold from 220 to 225. This is David Monk for MLA's National Livestock Reporting Service at Mount Barker.
David, thanks for helping out with the livestock markets this week. Tomorrow, finishing up the week, catching up with Danny Burkett and a wrap of the wool market. 1 o'clock.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.